My top five podcasters, Chris Lambert, and probably myself, but this ain't about that. The Mundane Festival is where you're at. If you've been tapped in, you know what's up. If you're a first timer, hey, welcome to the club. The cost of admission is simply a subscription, then rating and reviewing it wherever you listen. Don't worry about change ups, the cast won't break up. Even when that $1 million contract show up, a stand up guy who's a stand up comedian with a stance on everything from food to media. So welcome to the show, please take your seat. Let's find out what he's got in store this week. Who, me? I'm Don Will, your opening act. Thanks for coming out. Please clap. The Mundane Festival. With your host, Chris Lambert.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, October 17th, 2021. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. If you're really into this thing, go over to Apple Podcasts, give this show a 5-star review, let everybody know why you like it, because it's simply the right thing to do. But if you want to take your love and appreciation of this show to an even deeper level, go over to patreon.com/mundanefestival and subscribe. $3 a month for hours and hours and hours of bonus content. You get at least 2 bonus episodes a month, and it's good. There's really cool stuff back there, and I think you would enjoy it. This is episode 538. There's no guest. It's just me. I'm sitting here in my apartment. I need to fold some laundry. I need to throw some stuff away because I am on the verge of becoming a hoarder. There's some things that just need to go. There's some things that need to be thrown away, and I need to get on it to be a functional human being that's just normal. Whatever the dictionary definition of normal is, I need to be that way, and I need to be on that level. Right now, I'm below that level, but I've been extremely busy trying to get in my rest and all of that good stuff. I got some things I want to talk about. This has been a really busy but fun week. This past Thursday, I made my Broadway debut. We had been in previews for about 3 weeks, I want to say. And it was cool because I was working on Broadway and getting paid as a Broadway actor, but it didn't really hit me until Wednesday night. Wednesday night, I was driving to the theater and I had my GPS on, and I just saw this email from the company manager or the stage manager, I think. And it just said Broadway debut. And it was just, and I would later read, because I didn't read the email while I was driving, but it was a ceremony that they had before the curtain. And I just saw that email flash on my phone, and then I just was like, wow. And I just kind of got a little emotional while I was driving. And then, we did the, I was talking backstage to one of the cast members, and we were talking about, I got a little emotional. I didn't even open the email yet at the time when I saw it. And he was like, yeah, well, I'm 59 years old and I'm making my Broadway debut. And when I saw that email, I cried in my wife's lap, and I was like, oh shit. And I was like, wow. Yeah. I was like, I get it. I totally fucking get it. And then on Thursday, I was just running some errands before the show, before I was heading down to the city, and I just got emotional, and while I was driving, and got home, and then I just called my parents and just thanked them for everything, because it's an experience being an artist. I think being any, when you strive for something, whatever. It's always cliche when you, I know when I say I'm an artist, guys, but I am. But when you, I think when you go, when you're trying to get better at something or better at a craft or a practice, and it just, it takes you on a journey, and at the start of that journey and through most of the journey, my parents have been there. They've been there the whole time. And I just think about the sacrifices that they made, putting me in the position to be successful, like putting me on the playing field and equipping me with everything that I needed, along like financially, encouragement. And it was just a truly humbling experience, because I think nobody can be bigger than the art form itself. But the art form is, is something that's like larger than life. And even though you'll never, I don't know if you can be a master at your craft, but I think even as a master of your craft, you can still learn. You can constantly learn from the art form, and it teaches you how to get better. It teaches you about yourself, and it teaches you how to evolve. And that's one of the reasons why I just felt really humbled by it, because the ego is one thing where it's like, I don't do it as much, but you see things, you see people on TV, you see people doing their thing or not really doing their thing that well. You're like, I can fucking do that. And I'm fucking good. I'm better. I'm this, I'm that. And even if you are, when you're presented with the opportunity to be great, like when they say, here's your opportunity, you got this gig, now do it. And you do it, but it's still humbling when those opportunities come. And when you think about your journey, I think, you know, I've talked about COVID, and, you know, if it's taught us anything, it's, you know, I said it last week, you know, it's nothing is promised. And I am really trying to make the effort to really take all of this in. I was just filled with so much gratitude for my parents. And yeah, there are other people that helped me. And my parents were just like, well, you know, that's what we're supposed to do. You know, they're very like, they're very like down the company line of, you know, that's the obligation, but they did it. And, you know, they believed in me. And I just remember like when I was a senior in college, I was 22, and we went to this clearinghouse audition called the URTAs. I think it's called the University Residential Theater Association or something like that. And you pay them, like at the time, like almost 20 years ago, you would pay them $75, and you would submit to, you know, you'd submit to them, and then you'd go to this event that was a regional thing where you would go. I was in the Northeast, so we went to New York City, and I did two monologues, and they decided whether they wanted to pass you or not. And they had like some screening audition before, and I didn't get past the screening audition. I think that shit was a racket. And I think it might have been because I was a communications major and a theater minor, and they didn't pass me on. But what they did do, I'll get to that. And I was bummed out because my parents had taken off work. We got a hotel in the city, and, you know, thankfully we had some family friends that helped us out a little bit too. And, like to where to go and where to eat, all that crap, like all the good stuff like that. And we got to spend some time with some family friends, but like we were there for a job. I had a job to do, and I was like trying to, you know, get into grad school and try to, you know, get better at this thing called acting. And it, you know, and when that didn't work, I remember like just because I think we had like a two beds and my parents were in one, I was in one, and I was just like, they didn't see me cry, but I was just like, when I didn't get past. And then the next day they had this audition. I wish I remembered where that shit was. It was an audition at a coffee house for the people that didn't get past the screening process. You could do 1 minute of a monologue and then they would just, the schools that wanted to show up would show up. And I did 1 minute of like, I did a monologue forward from the Merry Wives of Windsor, which I actually saw the play a month ago at Shakespeare in the Park. And I did that monologue, and Roosevelt University was the one that that took me. And they said, you know, they said, hey, you know, I think we were at a hotel or something, and they went to the hotel, and it was the Custodes Knockus and June Compton were the reps from Roosevelt, and they just gave us a packet, and they said, we liked you. You could come out to Chicago and audition, and we'll talk. And that was my first time. So I didn't get anything from there. And then, so I got Roosevelt from there. So I got I don't know how they do that, if it was an offer or what. And then my mother and I went to Connecticut, to Yale, to audition. And my mother went out there with me, and we got a hotel. We got, you know, I did the audition, and I did two monologues, and Yale was like, why do you want to come here? And I said, well, you guys are the best, and I want to work with the best. And they said, well, most people wait. You're 22, and most people wait till they're a little older to come to Yale. And I said, well, I already know what I want to do. And so I was like, okay. And so I didn't get into Yale, obviously. If I did, I might not be doing this podcast. And sorry, guys. So blame Yale for not accepting me into their MFA program, for me to be talking to you on this fucking podcast. So I didn't get in. And then my dad and I flew out to Chicago for Roosevelt, but we had that Roosevelt meeting. And that was the first time I got on an airplane. And that was with my dad. And the first time that I got on a plane was to pursue my craft. And that's like the arts, you know, that took me on the plane, took me on the journey. My dad and I went to Chicago the night before the audition, and we ate. We had real deep dish pizza for the first time from Giordano's. We got it delivered to the hotel room, and that was cool. Then we had breakfast at the Holiday Inn that we were staying at. One of the best omelets I think that I've ever had in my life, actually. And I went into, met with June Compton, and I thought she was a black woman at first, but with her voice, but she's a white lady. She's really cool. And I think I did a monologue for her. And then she said to me, like, damn, I hope I don't tear up. I don't know. But she said to me, she's like, yeah, you know, we saw your monologue, and we kind of know when somebody opens their mouth within the first 5 or 10 seconds, something like that. Within like a short amount of time, we know if they're worth it. And they liked me. I think I just had a good showing, a good meeting. And I got into the program, and I said, Mom, Dad, do you think we can do this financially? And they were just like, they fucking made it happen. And that's what they've been doing my whole life. So it was just like, so I got to Chicago and the fall of 2002. That was the first time I had really been away from home like that. Like I always say, you've heard me talk about this on the show if you listen for a long time, where it was just like being in being at Mount St. Mary's, an hour and a half from home, that's away from home. And but it's not away. Like, I was in another time zone in Chicago, and I, you know, built a community for myself out there and met some really cool people. Some I'm still in contact with today. And it took me on my journey, and I learned about myself. I got really good at acting. I think, and then I made the shift to New York and was trying to do it. And New York kind of sat me down a little bit. And I was thinking about, like, well, what can I do? Like, I always say how a city kind of shapes you into something, like, in a positive way. And I think it shaped me into a comedian, where I've been suppressing those feelings of wanting to do that for a long time. And I remember working on this play in 2007, and it was his brother, Satie Word, really talented dude, who passed away a while back. And I remember I was jealous of this dude because he was cool, talented, and he would get these cool parts, and he wasn't in grad school. He wasn't in theater school. He was just fucking good. And I remember one time him telling me, he said something like, we were goofing off before the show. We were goofing off, like, warming up before the house opened, and we're doing, like, this storefront. I guess you could call, like, Victory Gardens. I don't know what it's like now, but it's like Victory Gardens in Chicago was not far from DePaul. It was on the north side of Chicago, and it was a place that housed these different theaters, like maybe three or four at the time, I think. I don't know. But that's what it was. And we were working on this play, and we were just kind of goofing off, warming up. And he was like, Chris, you ought to try stand up. And I was like, I don't know. I was afraid. He's like, you ought to go down to Jokes and Notes and go to this spot that, you know, like, you'd have Clark Jones that's been on the show. Will Miles has been on the show. Hannibal Buress, you know, kind of got started there. And I was just kind of afraid. I feared it. I was afraid of it. I was afraid to do it. I just kind of, you know, brushed it off. And then when I finally started stand up, he knew about it. Satie knew about it, and he was like, good, man, that's good. I know you're not doing no bullshit like I see some of these other people do. And he was right. I started that, and, you know, for 12 years, going on 13, that was what I did in New York. And it, you know, I did, like, JL sketches and would do little acting work here and there, but it was stand up that kind of opened me up and made me, I think it helped make me a better artist. I think it, you know, it, I was looking, actually, you know, I was looking at, I was thinking about making a heartfelt Instagram cliche post. I was trying to find a picture of me as an actor when I was a kid, like when I was in elementary school. I thought that I had it up here. I'm not sure if I do or not. And then I was looking at this book, this photo album where I had, like, of me at camp, of me working at camp, and some of the kids that was at the camp. I was really fucked. First of all, I was bummed out because I was like, God damn, I was handsome back then. I think I'm handsome, but I've gained some LBs and all that stuff. But I'm still a handsome dude when I'm cleaned up, and I, you know, I'm going to give myself that. But I was like, God damn, I was hot. And I didn't know it. I'm like one of those girls, like, you look at one of those girls on, well, Instagram. I think all of those women know that they're hot. So I don't know if that's the right analogy, but one of those women that are like, they don't know how hot they are. That was me back then when I was in my early 20s. I was looking at all those pictures and I was like, man, that's crazy. I found all those pictures when I was at camp. But that theater camp, and I talk about that a lot because I think that was a I think that was another turning point for me, because I think when you're young, you think you just, your ego is so huge. And I did a good, I think I did a great job of masking it, but I still had this ego that I'm the shit. And it was just, cause you have to have some kind of an ego on you to pursue the arts, like to pursue like being a stand up or an actor. And I just realized like how it made me a better actor, because initially I was just like, well, I just want this teaching job so I can still live in Chicago and I can get an apartment. And my parents, again, they said, hey, if you want to live in Siri, I don't need you. If you want to live in the city during the summer on your summer break, then, you know, you got to get a job. So I came back with two. I came back with that job at the Skokie Park District. And I came back with a part-time job at Best Buy, and they helped me out because they knew that I was serious about, you know, trying to do this. And I think they just believed in me. And well, they did. They still do. But anyway, I got that job. And initially it was just like, I want to stay in the city. I want to hang out and be young in the fucking city. And that just was the best. I always say, I'll go to my grave and say that's the best job I ever had, because I love working with those kids. I loved seeing for them what they didn't see within themselves. Like, say, no, you can do this part. You can do this. And seeing them grow and seeing them get it, see the wheels start to turn, and seeing them develop a love for either a love for acting or just develop more confidence in who they were as young people. And that was really like just great for me, because it made me a better actor. It made me have more informed performances, and it helped me grow. So it was mutual growth for the kids and for me. And to work with those kids over, a 3 to 4 year period. Some of them came back to the camp, some of them aged out, but seeing people at the end of that experience was just like, I remember, so I started out as a teacher there, and by the end I was running the camp. And when you run in the camp, you're more of an administrator, and you can see you. So you're not as hands on. I wasn't as hands on as I used to be. I remember seeing this girl who I had when she was 8 years old, and she was playing. She played the Wicked Witch of the West, and she did the scene where she's like, "Oh, I'm melting." You know, she did that, and then to just see her like blossom, doing like she was just. They were rehearsing. And I saw her, she was just like standing on stage by herself, delivering a monologue. And it was just like, yeah, she's a beast now, you know? So just seeing her come into her own, and like, I think she was 8. And then by the time you're done, you're like 12 or 13 or something like that. So it was just like a really cool thing. And then coming to New York could beat you down. And just like starting stand up just kind of got me back into acting. And, you know, there's so much. And I think like Chicago was very like cliquey in a lot of ways, and people had their tribes and everything. And I don't think I ever officially broke in, even though I worked, and I was working like before I graduated and before I left, I was consistently working. Chicago, you can work, you can learn your craft, but you eventually have to move because there's a ceiling. And I did it. A couple of my friends did it, and some others that I wasn't as close to did it. And some are moving on to have like great careers. But I noticed that. But at the same time, I wasn't like when I had Derek Sanders on, one of my like OGs in theater. I wasn't really the right age to be playing a lot of the stuff. Excuse me, a lot of the stuff that that I was going for, because I was a big dude, look at those pictures, really big, handsome dude. But I wasn't old enough yet, And now I'm that age where I can do all those roles. So hopefully more will come. We'll see. But anyway, but then to make the transition and to just really grind and hustle and go on all these auditions and not get anything, and then to start booking stuff. And one day I'll tell you, I think when it's over, maybe on Patreon, I'll talk about this audition for this play. But I got it. And I did it. Like I, you know, like regardless of what level of the part was or how big the part is, I had to. And that same dude that told me he cried in his wife's arms was like, at the party, at the opening night party, he was like, we can't say that this part is small anymore. We did it. We're on Broadway. We're in the company. We're in the cast. They can't take that away from me. And I posted, like, there's some level of secrecy or like weird shit that you can't talk about, that I can't really talk about the play, but I had to say, fuck it. You know, I made my Broadway debut last night, and these motherfuckers on Facebook and Twitter need to know that shit. You know, like that's a life achievement. You know, one of the managers of the play was saying that. So we had this ceremony, and she said before the ceremony, she said at the ceremony, she said, there's a one, I don't know if this is right. She said there's a 1 in 11,000 chance of making it on Broadway or something like that. And I had thought that I had got all the tears out that morning to my parents. But I did tear up a little bit, but nobody saw me like, I did that on the phone with my parents. You know, it's just a really, I was just filled with like so much gratitude, like the bullshit that people post on social media. It's not bullshit. I think it's real, but I did feel that. I was humbled by it, because you think that you know, your ego will tell you that I'm fucking, you know, I don't know. It's fascinating to me, because you know, like I can do it. I can do the work. I can do more if presented with the opportunity. But I'm just going to, like, for now, I'm just going to appreciate this moment in time and really try to be present for all of it and everything that it entails, and just like it's just a real, when I think about that journey, I think about when I was a kid, we used to this is October, it's Halloween time, and I remember in my school we used to have these Halloween parades, where, you know, you wear that little cheap plastic costume, and then you have the like Darth Vader mask or whatever, and you got to walk around in front of your family and friends, or your family and shit. I used to cry. I used to be scared of that shit. I was afraid. And there were two pivotal moments, I think, in my youth. I don't think I've ever shared this before. So I used to cry at those little Halloween parades. There was this one play. I don't remember the play, I don't remember the name of the play, but it was about this snowman. And it was a snowman that came to life, and there was a evil villain. I think the villain's name was Freddy Fast Talk. And I think they wanted me to play the snowman that came to life, and I was afraid. And so I didn't do it, and I think I was just one of the like ensemble people. And I remember like being jealous of the kid that played Freddy Fast Talk. There was a song, the song was called, I think it was like Deep Freeze. He's gonna put you in the deep freeze. And I think that Freddy Fast Talk said, I don't want you melting away. I'm gonna put you in the deep freeze. And then the chorus was like, deep freeze, I'm begging you please, deep freeze. He's gonna put him in the deep freeze. I think we were in fifth or sixth grade. That's all that I remember for that. But I think that I did want to be one of those characters, the snowman or Freddy Fast Talk, but I was afraid of the moment. And then I was afraid of it in seventh grade when I moved to this new school, Mount Calvary, to where I think they did want me to play Lewis in The King and I, which is the lead character's son. I think he had a song or two. And I'm really getting into these Al Bundy moments, but I was afraid to do that. So I played the king's servant and I had a couple lines. And that was seventh grade. And then in eighth grade, I was Max in The Sound of Music. You've probably heard me talk about that before, but that was a moment where, like, my dad told me, and you can kind of blame my dad for this too, but where I was in junior high, 13, 14 years old. And I thought, like, yeah, I want to play sports. And this is like this. I want to be cool and play sports. I love sports, but I wasn't that good. And I hit my peak at 12 years old. And in basketball, I was like the Robert Horry of my team because, I think I was like the Robert Horry of my team. And that same kid that played Freddy Fast Talk, he came on my second year and he was like old. He's a kid that like stayed back and he was like bigger than us. And he was really good at football and basketball and he helped our team. The first year I played basketball, I think around organized basketball, was like fifth grade, and we sucked. And I helped us win our only game. And the next year we got better. We were like 12-0 or whatever. We won. Nobody beat us. We were undefeated, won the chip. And I think I got upset at some game where I didn't play as well as I wanted to. And we lost. I think we won, but I was mad at myself and I cried. And then after that, they put me on the bench because I cried, because I got emotional about it, because I wanted to do better or some shit like that. And I just came off the bench, played good defense and could shoot a little bit. Where was I going with that? So eighth grade was The Sound of Music. And I did not want to play Captain Von Trapp because I was at a predominantly white school. And there was this one girl, I'm not going to say her full name, Lori, who was pretty, but it's pretty blonde girl, really sweet, really nice. And I was like, oh, and this is when I started really like understanding race. And I was like, I can't be Captain Von Trapp and be with this white girl now. Back if I knew what I knew now, I mean, whatever. get down, girl. Go ahead. Get down. All right. So I would have just did the part, but that was the lead. But I said, you know what? I could do Max because Max was funny. He had two songs and he had a girl. He had a song with a girl. Actually, my friend was, she was white too. The Elsa in that play, she was played by a white actress in that show. And so I did that show and it was really fun. And my dad told me that all the black parents, because it was a predominantly white school, white administration, it was still in PG County. So it was like black kids there, but the black parents, my dad was telling me that the black parents were proud of me. And I don't know. I think it was at the end of the show. I think it was at the end of the last show where we presented gifts to like the director and the teachers that were involved in the play. And I had to speak in front of like the whole school and everything like that. And my dad said, you know, the parents were really proud of me, like the black parents especially. And I was like, oh, this is my thing. And that's where it kind of, I was like, oh, this is what I am. This is who I am. I'm an actor. And that's who I want to be when I grow up. And ever since then, I really pursued it. I had some missteps where that same, so we got the freshman year. And okay, so like when we played, when I played baseball and I would strike out, and I remember, I don't want to say the name because it's not anything bad, but like I used, when I would strike out when we were playing baseball, this one kid's dad, black father, shout out to black father. He would say, he said, "That's all right, Hollywood. You good?" Like he would, I think I might've said this before, but he just said, "Yeah, you're playing baseball, but you're an actor. I saw you in that play. You're Hollywood." And like, that just, that was just something that was like, that had an effect on me. And that's how this stuff can affect these kids. And when you talk to them, you know, and he was just like, "That's all right, Hollywood. You're good. Don't worry about it. This team sucks. You're going to be an actor." And I remember, freshman year when I went to Bishop McNamara, that same kid that played Captain Von Trapp, looking in hindsight, you can kind of catch these things, but I will still go back to the same kid that played Captain Von Trapp was in this play called The Matchmaker. And for some reason I didn't audition. There was still this fear. There was still this like me not being self-aware, still trying to, I'm going to play basketball. I went to that basketball tryout. I could not fucking dribble. I had on sweatpants. I didn't switch to shorts. I had on these goggles. I just didn't fucking. And after that first tryout, I didn't even have to look at the sheet at the end. I knew I didn't make it. And I saw this play, The Matchmaker, and this kid got one of the lead roles. He's not a good actor. He was so wooden, but he got to kiss one of the prettiest girls in the school, who was also a cheerleader. And I said, "Okay, that's it. I'm not gonna not audition for these shows anymore. I'm gonna audition for every show." And ever since then, I've been in it. But I don't know. Some Al Bundy moments. Some defining moments in my long career, and I count that shit. I count that school shit because it fucking counts. It counts, young. Shout out to the Firestarter crew. That shit count. So I come a long way, and it's just really humbling to see stuff come into fruition. And I, God willing, this is only the beginning. I've said a few times on this show, I'm 41 years old, and I feel like I'm just getting started. Sometimes people skyrocket, and but that steady grind, that steady pace, that constant, that incremental progress that I talk about a lot, I think that's what's happening for me. And I just want to just really, I would be remiss if I didn't kind of reflect on Thursday night. And it was really, really cool, and I'm glad that my parents were alive to see that happen for me, to even though they're not at the show, but they, you know, they were there, constantly there with me. So I'm happy that they're around to really see some of these. Like, they've seen, I took them to see me and Can You Ever Forgive Me, my moment as the exterminator that tells Melissa McCarthy's character that he is not going to fumigate the room until she cleans it up because it smelled horribly. So there we go. My first feature film was an Oscar nominated film, and my first Broadway play, possibly, it's getting rave reviews, possibly Tony Award nominations for the main actors involved, and probably the set design, and that the whole team involved in the production. So when people say yes to me, the projects that I'm involved with are, for the most part, have been really fucking cool. And some of the brothers in a text chain were congratulating me and stuff like that. And they, you know, said, "Oh, Chris, that's awesome. It's amazing. I'm proud of you." And I texted them back and I said, you know, thanks for giving me a community when I felt like I was shut out. A lot, oftentimes felt like I was shut out. And especially like in the comedy community, I feel like this shit is turning into the righteous prick. But shout out to my homie JL. Oh, man. Well, Half Blackface is sold out. The taping is so, but we'll get to see it soon after he releases it. But oftentimes, like, I felt shut out of this. Like, I think that I'm a comedian that's worthy of being in New York City in one of the toughest places to perform and be seen or acknowledged. I think I can stand with anybody in the city. That's facts. And a lot of times, whether it's a click thing, it's a whatever it is, you know, I feel like myself and a lot of my friends, I've talked about it before, even if you exclude, you take me out of it. I've said that so many times, but I'm gonna put me in it this time. I feel like I can do all these shows that I see people doing, and I see people that are not good. And I see some people, you know, they gave me community when other people didn't. And they made me feel like I was a part of it, and they made me feel special, and they made me feel welcome, and that I had people to talk to. Especially in a city like this, and it's people that are doing for self. And if I named them, I'd miss some of them, and then they'd be like, "Nigga, you ain't even say me." So they know who they are, and I appreciate them, because I think when you do something like this, you need people around you that are positive and people that are like trying to do something and doing something for themselves and not waiting around for somebody to do something for them. So that being said, that, you know, I really appreciate everything, and you know who you are. Y'all know who y'all are. God, I've rambled enough about this, I think, but I felt like I had to say something about that. Kyrie Irving he went on Instagram Live a couple days ago and said a whole lot of nothing. I like Kyrie. I want him to try to pursue this championship. I think he should get vaxxed. You know, when I went on that rant, I don't know if I went on a rant, but the episode that was Dear Kyrie Irving, maybe this will be Dear Kyrie Irving 2. Dear Kyrie Irving 2 in my Broadway debut. How about that? You see all the talent that he has. And you're just like, you're in your, like the homies on the Firestarter crew, they was like, you know, he's in his prime. You don't want to see it wasted. You want to see this guy try to get it, man. You want to see him, a healthy Kyrie, KD, and James Harden go after this chip. And this, they need him. Could they do it without him? Yeah, but they need him. There was a Deadspin article, or I believe, that said, like, if Giannis is doing this, things can be more dangerous for the NBA. And it was saying, like, Giannis is working on his jump shot. And Giannis is already a monster, and now he's working on his shit. He's continuing to work on his craft and getting better. So it's like, it's an arms race. Every year it's an arms race for these guys. They're trying to get better, and they're adding players and moving them around, and, you know, trying to, it's not going to be easy. So they need him. I'm, you know, like, I want to see him play, but like this whole thing, I don't know, man. Like, cause I'm kind of done with talking bad about, you know, about him, but it's just like, I just want to see him play. I want to, it's like, like, get your money, man. Make that, keep getting that generational wealth, dog. Help your family out. I don't know. It's just like an ego thing. Cause it is kind of selfish. If you wanted to take a stance like this, and I think other people have said this before, play tennis or golf. But this is a team sport, and you talk like it's being selfish. All these other guys on the team got vaccinated so they could play and earn a living. You know, yeah, these guys make this exorbitant amount of money, but it's a job. Just like Broadway is a job, like being a Broadway actor is a job, and there's things that you have to do. There's requirements. We have to take a COVID test 3 times a week, you know, and we have to be vaccinated. You know, it's just what you have to do. So, I mean, if you choose to not do that, then you will not be working. That's what it is. It just seems like it was just a whole lot of nothing. And if he doesn't want to play, I can't force the guy to play. He said, "You think I like missing money?" I was like, "Dude, I don't know, man. It's a bummer because you want to see him play." And I don't know. Like I said the last time, it's easy to make these stances about Black Lives Matter. And when it comes to, and like to stop killing Black people and things like that, that's an obvious thing that you want to. And I don't even think this vaccine stuff has that much nuance to it. Yeah, is the medical industry to a degree racist with all the stuff that happened with shit? Now I've thought about it so much with Tuskegee. With the atrocity that was, a Tuskegee experiment. But when you see white people jump in the line to get this vaccine, this miracle drug that is allowing people like me to work, to function to a certain degree like we did before this pandemic happened, to see, like, for people to be doing, like I said this for almost 2 years, the 18 months, where all the stuff that I like to do was shut down. I like to do stand up. I like to act. I like to go to concerts. All that stuff is coming back. Like, you guys played basketball through that. And now it's something out there to help you. Kevin Durant had COVID. Your friend had it. And it's just like, again, it just seems like a slap in the face to people like Karl Anthony Towns that lost his mother and other relatives. I saw this actress, I think I might have talked about it before, this actress that has a grandmother or aunt, I think it was an aunt, that didn't get vaccinated, and she's gone now because she wouldn't take it. There's a comedian that had it, I don't know, that passed away recently, that I don't know if he was vaccinated. But part of me feels like if he was vaccinated, the people who were anti-vaxxers would say, "He died and he was vaccinated, so fuck you, bro," you know? But nobody's saying that. So I kind of feel like he wasn't vaccinated. And it's sad because I was looking at this dude's credits and it's like he's the same age, a year younger than me, and was killing it in L.A. That was doing it in L.A., a big brother. I don't want to say his name because I don't want people to like say, "Well, you didn't know." I'm just saying the guy was basically a L.A. version of me. Possibly more talented because he could rap and was getting credits and eating out there. So this vaccine is a miracle drug. It's not, it's better than what we had 18 months ago. So I just, I don't know. Like I love the NBA. I love watching these guys play. It really hurts me when they get hurt, because you want to see everybody at their full potential and you want to see them go at it. You want to see everybody healthy and you want to see the best product that you can possibly see. And I like seeing these brothers get that money, man. Get that money, man. If you're not doing it for yourself, do it for your kids. I don't know. I it just bums me out. But I said before, like, it's 90-something% as I'm talking to you guys. I'm breaking the fourth wall. I'm talking to you on Saturday at 9:53 a.m. right now. So it's like, you know, get vaccine. Get vaccinated, Kyrie. You know? Get vaxxed, dude. Hoop. You're a hooper. I don't know, that's not the only thing that defines him, but that's who he is, and he's one of the best at it. So you just want to see, you know, but if he doesn't want to do that, if he doesn't want to play, then that's on him. I think, I don't know if KD has said anything about it yet. At the time, I think I might have saw a clip about KD saying something, but I don't want to put that on him or anything. But I, and I think Bomani Jones did mention this about KD, is that he cares about his friends and he's really not going to, regardless of what he believes in his heart, KD's not going to publicly ridicule a teammate, let alone a friend, because the media will just like have at it. So I don't see KD saying anything to Kyrie about, like, in the media about it. I'm sure he's talked to him. So young, you got to get your shit together so we can get this chip. Giannis is working on his jump shot. It's not going to be that easy. LA is looking good. LA, like, they try to talk about how LA is so old and everything, but they put that shit together. I played with him on 2K. We'll see. I haven't played 2K22 yet, but I updated my roster like a couple weeks ago. You know, you do the update and whatever. And they look good. They're going to be good. Golden State is going to be good. So, I mean, it's not going to be easy, man. So I just want to see him playing, man. Like, you know, I just think, you know, he's being a contrarian, and people are, because at the, before I started recording this, I was like, I don't really bash people, but it just frustrates me. But if he doesn't want to play, he doesn't want to play, and he'll get replaced by Patty Mills. So it is what it is. There's a couple other things I wanted to talk about before I wrap it up. I did not know that I was going to give you a mini retrospective thing about my career or whatever, but I just felt like I should say something. The Chappelle drama, and maybe you can make some connections to what I was talking about a little earlier, but I think Dave Chappelle, so like I don't agree with the jokes about the gay or trans things, and Randolph and I talked about it last week, but I think when you get, he's in a realm that we've never seen before. And he's saying this stuff, and you can't cancel this guy. So the cancel culture is going on the people that are talking bad about him, like these Netflix employees that are talking about boycotting and walking out. Like they're getting fired. Somebody leaked some information to Bloomberg about the special. There's a Bloomberg piece that came out. When did this come out? This came out October 13th. Netflix raised concerns about Chappelle's special before its release. The company is dealing with an internal outcry unprecedented in its history. And this is by Lucas Shaw. And it came out on the 13th. There was, let me just see. Yeah. All right. Let me read some of this. So obviously, some employees raised concern about the offensive material and Dave Chappelle's new comedy special, The Closer, days before its release, warning, executives that a series of jokes about gender-neutral pronouns and the genitalia of transgender people was potentially inflammatory and damaging. The company's leaders, including global head of TV Bella Bajaria and co-chief executive officer Ted Sarandos, decided the show didn't cross the line, sparking Netflix's most significant public labor dispute in recent memory. Employees have taken their grievances to internal forums and Twitter. At least three were suspended for crashing a meeting, then reinstated following an outcry. Now the company is planning to host an internal event with trans activist Alec Vade Menon, meanwhile employees are planning a walkout on October 20th. What is wrong with my reading? So this is some of the stuff that was leaked here. Let me see. Sarandos just basically stood behind the special. That was earlier in the week. I think this is the info that was leaked. The comedian's popularity comes at a cost. Netflix spent $24.1 million on The Closer, slightly more than the $23.6 million it paid for Chappelle's 2019 special, Sticks and Stones. By comparison, the streaming service spent $3.9 million for Inside, Bo Burnham's recent hour-and-a-half special, the 9-episode Squid Game, which delivered the best debut in Netflix history, cost $21.4 million. By Netflix's own measurement, Sticks and Stones had an impact value of $19.4 million, meaning it cost more than the value it generated, according to internal documents reviewed by Bloomberg. The company also evaluates its programs by efficiency, which balances the show's reach and price tag. On that scale, Chappelle's special scored a 0.8, less than the break-even score of 1. By comparisons, Bo Burnham's Inside scored 2.8. That doesn't mean the show was unprofitable. Netflix doesn't report how much money any single offering makes the company. Chappelle's specials are among the most popular of any comedian on the service. Sticks and Stones won 2 Emmy Awards and a Grammy Award. It's a good little read. It's interesting because, you know, people are going to watch this if they really love Dave Chappelle and if they really hate him. So they're going to watch it. But the thing about this is, like, with Chappelle, it's like we were talking last week when I was talking with Randolph. It's like you want the best to be better. It's like upgrading your software on your phone. Like, I've used that analogy constantly. Like, when things change, you update your software and you evolve. And Dave is not evolving in that regard. And then you have all these other old school comics with their Hotepian approval. It's just disheartening. And then when you get to that level, man, I mean, this happens when you get really rich and famous. You have people around you that are yes men that do not challenge you to be better and did not say, hey, you shouldn't put that out. Like, I have a brain trust, you know. I reached out to Randolph and Andy before I put Field Running Back out, and I let them hear it, and I said, the first track is about me talking about Kobe, because I did that set the night that he died. And there was parts of it that I took out because I said, people aren't going to like that. And it was funny in the room, but, you know, it's just, I took it out because you got to edit yourself, basically. But they, even on my level as an unknown comedian, I just kind of felt like, I probably shouldn't do that. But, you know, for the room, it worked. But I'm not trying to say that I'm morally superior than Dave Chappelle, but I just think there's people that want to be his friend and want to be in good standing with him, so they're not going to say anything. That's kind of a hard thing because there's your livelihood depends on this guy. Some people's livelihood depend on him. him being in good standing with them. Did I say that right? You don't want to rock the boat, so you don't want to tell. You can't tell Dave Chappelle, "Hey, dude, why are you doing that? You shouldn't. Maybe you shouldn't do that bit. Take some of the spice out of that fastball, or don't do that bit." I've been in a situation where I'm not going to talk about that. So I just think he's not censoring himself. There's nobody that is saying, "Hey, dude, why don't you talk about something else?" But he's just doubling down on it. And you can't really cancel this guy. And it seems like if you protest against him and you work for Netflix, you probably won't have a job. A couple people got fired. I mean, New York Post, what is it? Let's see. They said Netflix empire. Yeah, so the Netflix employee who leaked the info about Dave Chappelle, so it was how much he was paid for it. That person got fired. So, yeah, those are the people that's the person that's getting canceled from this shit. You're not going to cancel Dave Chappelle, and you really can't. What you could do is just not watch his stuff if it makes you feel bad. And this is not me trying to say, if you don't fucking like it, don't watch. If it triggers you and it makes you feel bad, don't watch it. Maybe you think less of the man doing the jokes, you know, and they are jokes, but I think it's just like, I'm not going to censor that. You shouldn't do that bit. Then sometimes it's like, hey, maybe don't do that bit because that's something a dude off the street could do. And it's kind of, it's pedestrian, some of it. I've seen people do stuff in specials that recently where it's just like, that's just not good. It's just mediocre. And you see, but then it's just, you see people get this stuff. And in the scheme of things, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you can take Dave out of that. Take Dave out of the equation. Just some stuff that I've seen people do recently. It's like, that's what you're doing? You've had all this time to build an hour in a pandemic. You've had opportunities to be on stage, and this is what you do. And I guess if you have an audience and if you're famous, it don't matter because people like you. And if they like you, they're just going to take the shit that you do. And just that's the thing that person did. And okay. And all of this shit is subjective anyway. And so it doesn't really matter. But like I said, if you know that you're not going to like what Dave has to say about certain topics, I would just stay away from it. But the fact that you can't make other people not like it. Like, you guys like this thing. Well, I hate it. You stay away from that thing. And, you know, don't make it worse on yourself. And I see where like Hannah Gadsby is fighting with Netflix. She fighting with him after she done did two. She did two specials with Netflix. Now she's going at him. You know, she gets, you know, I think that's just like rich people fighting with each other. Like, it's just funny. Like, Dave Chappelle's like, my rich friend. He didn't say this, but it's like my rich friend Kevin Hart wanted to do it his whole life. I don't think he wanted to host the Oscars his whole life. I think it's a gig that he wanted, and he just didn't get because he didn't want to comply with the thing. So that's a choice that he made, and that was a few years ago. And Kevin is doing just fine. So it goes. You know, I have not gotten to play my PlayStation, and I need to spend some quality time with my PlayStation. I have not, but like while I'm backstage, like recently within the last few months, there's this game called Retro Bowl, and it's an app. It's a football game that looks like Tecmo Bowl, and it's essentially like a Tecmo Bowl, and like a what do you call that thing? Emulator? It looks like Tecmo Bowl, but it's called Retro Bowl, and it's fucking amazing. I started playing it a little bit like last year or something, and I put it down. Then I started picking it up when I had time to just chill backstage in the dressing room. And it's so addictive. It's so addictive. And they have like in-game purchases, and I've spent like $7 on it. And that's a lot for me. I don't do I stay away from all these phone games that these apps that you download. I've stayed away from them, and I'm just fucking addicted to this shit. And it's fun. So I know it's on iPhone. I'm sure it's on other phones as well. But it's just like, if you like Tecmo Bowl as a kid and you're bored and you want to play some like video game football, it's good. And then come to find out, like, I got this one, another cast member on it. And then like this other cast member was like, oh, I'm in season 78 of he's like deep into it. And he was telling us all about it, man. And it's intense, man. It's fun. So I've been getting into Retro Bowl and Tetris is what I've been getting into. One of my homies had a Nintendo Switch. I'm really tempted, but I think I better stay away for a while. I want to play that Metroid. I want to play Zelda. But I'm just probably not going to have enough time for that shit. Music. I want to recommend Loot from rapper Loot from Charlotte, North Carolina. He's got an album out called Gold Mouth. His debut joint. It's dope. It's a really solid, above average album. My favorite record on there, I would say, if you've never heard of him or if you're interested in him, listen to this record called GED. I think it's called Get Every Dollar. Getting Every Dollar or Get Every Dollar? I just want to make sure I got it right. And my man, shout out to Big Doe, who is one on his management team. Big Doe has been on the podcast and he supported my stand up comedy, and I did not have to be famous for him to come to my show. He came to several of my shows and he's super nice, and he's on the management team. It's Getting Every Dollar, the second track on the album. And then, you know, Little Brother's on here. Big Pooh is on his management team as well. It's just a solid, it's a very good album. When I say solid, I'm not trying to be dismissive. It's just like hits hard. I listened to it like 3 times and I want to listen to it more. So I'm going to do that. But Big Pooh is one of the executive producers along with J. Cole and Ibrahim Hamad. And Big Doe is who used to manage Little Brother, is on his management team as well. So definitely check this out. It's a really good album, man. Really dope cover too. And Lute is getting it. He was on Fonte's So Help Me God record off of No News Is Good News. So really strong debut from him, man. Really glad, because I was like, okay, when is this shit coming out? And it came out. I bought it. I put money down on iTunes or whatever and copped it. What else? Oh, and before I wrap up, I really did like Squid Game. I enjoyed it. Really fun. Really good. If you really want to go deep in it, there's one Korean woman on TikTok that was talking about like how to watch it on like with the subtitles and stuff, and she was like, this takes away the meaning from this. I was like, okay, I'm getting confused, because I'm already trying not to be xenophobic by by watching it, you know. No, I recommend Burning. I think I told people to watch Burning and Shoplifters, but anyway, Burning is really good. It's long, but it's great. That's what she said, or he said. Anyway, it's good, but she was talking about like the subtitles. I was like, okay, I'm getting confused. Like, it's all these poor people who are trying to make money, and they essentially the last person standing is the winner. So these are people, that's essentially what the movie's about, what the show is about. And that's the nuts and bolts. But if you want to go deeper in it, look at that. Look at YouTube. Look at what she said on her TikTok. Because it kind of confused me, because I was like maybe halfway through when I saw that like TikTok and I saw that article. I was like, I'm going to just continue to watch it the way that I was watching it and enjoying it. And hopefully it's one, like I read that in that Bloomberg piece, a lot of people are enjoying it, and hopefully they come back with more. Hopefully, if not a season two, but if something else, it opens people up to some great art. You know what I mean? So without further ado, I think that's it. That's it. That's enough. I've talked to you guys enough. You've had enough of me today, this week. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I appreciate you, and I will talk to you next time. Take it easy, everybody.